Common Ground is a private, not-for-profit organization offering dispute resolution services to the people in Columbia and Greene counties. Common Ground provides trained mediators who work to resolve the differences between two or more participants on issues including family, housing, business, workplace, school, and neighborhood disputes. The mediation process is informal, private, confidential, and voluntary. For more information, please contact Common Ground at 518-943-0523.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, and enemies, you're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. Name of the show is Good Night, Norman, right here on WGXC 90.7 FM. In beautiful downtown Hudson, New York. It's October 2nd. And just after midnight. Did you know that Wave Farms programs, including WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears, would not be possible without your generous support? And we're grateful. I know I am. We hope to hear from many of you during fall WGXC Pledge Drive, which will focus on local sounds. The Pledge Drive is October 4th through the 13th. So go to WGXC.org, click on the donate button, give a dollar a month, give $4 a month, give whatever you can, but don't give up. Tonight, this morning, it's not really breaking tradition anymore, since I've done this already a few times, but this time I'm going to read a brand new story that doesn't even have a title yet. I finished it on the full moon, and I read it on the full moon. Now, it doesn't matter what the moon is anymore. Not tonight, anyways. I mean, I guess it does. Who knows? Anyways. It starts with a little epigraph from the, I guess he was a philosopher, essayist, Montaigne, French guy, lived in the 16th century from 1533 to 94. This is apparently a note. Or his interpretation of, not his entire interpretation, but his interpretation of some lines from Lucretius on the nature of things, because we do not go. We are carried away like floating objects, now gently, now violently, according as the water is angry or calm. Here's the untitled story that goes with. I can't sleep anymore. It's hard to recall that I ever could. The truth is, I'm afraid to sleep. It isn't nightmares. Probably started with nightmares, sure. They worked as a gateway phenomenon. The sudden impasse, the certainty that I'd ended up trapped, the threat of loss or pain or death, no longer a threat, now definite, so real I could smell it, taste it. I would feel my skin crawling even as my being slept on, fully alarmed, deeply apprehensive of what would soon envelop me. A suffocating wave that rode and crested all through my insides, menacing my interstitium, the gut brain. A surge that impersonated its own weird and paralyzing trough of crashing doom, its core turbulence, a deadliness doubling down. And then suddenly, in the swamp of sweat pooled under the victimless crime scene outlined by my body, deserved a contemptuous snigger from the salvation I heard nowhere in the black silence of the bed's nighttime serenity. I lay awake. I sulked, mortified by the slick, masterful trickery I had apparently just perpetrated against myself. What did it mean, this persistent plot my sleeping brain had undertaken to embarrass me in front of myself like this, alone in the dark? Why did I keep doing this to myself? Had I lost my mind, or did my waking behaviors somehow involve offenses that earned me this unending procession of nocturnal torments? Did I slam a door in an old lady's face? Should I have tipped the waitstaff more? Maybe I shouldn't have looked so hard and long at that dark-skinned woman's butt this morning. Recent incidents took on the shape of the shifty. Their recurrent aftermath endured and reemerged as polymorphs, mocking me to live long days. I stoked my now clearly baseless terror with the smoldering embers of an anger that persisted until long after daybreak. I stacked wretched notions of guilt on top of each consecutive ordeal. I didn't share this with anyone but Trudy, my partner. Not the horrors I dreamed up or my worries over my daily conduct, but because we shared a bed now and then, she heard me whimper and cry out, saw me wriggle and writhe. She felt me twitch, toss, tremble, turn. She cringed at the rattle and crunch, me clenching my jaw, grinding my teeth. At some point, we talked about living together. We'd known each other for a while, a year and a half, nearly two. We had our own places. One morning, after we successfully wrestled ourselves to orgasm, she broke the twinned catching of breath to broach the subject of moving in. I like sleeping with you, she said, before she added, when you sleep. But I cut her off. I easily guessed the gist of what she would say next. I wanted to make light of it. Sounds like a big butt, bigger than yours, I grinned, hoping she'd add some levity. We both liked her big butt, felt proud of it, got excited over it, however differently. I guess maybe it is bigger than my butt, she responded thoughtfully. Oh. I don't know if I'm going to like this, I said. Me neither, she said, but I can't sleep with you anymore. Talk about nightmares. I felt my ego started stupid ego dance all around my insides. I wouldn't call it a happy dance. On the other hand, sad doesn't fit either. I like you a lot, she said. It's just the nightmares. It's like, I know, I said, those fucking nightmares. Why won't they stop? I put a lot of extra whiny in my voice, annoyed her. I don't know, maybe she should get up. Maybe she should get help, she sighed. I prodded myself to feel offended, get indignant. What the fuck is that supposed to mean, other than the fact that you don't want to help? I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? Not just with me, it's everyone. Nobody wants to help anybody but themselves. But nobody can figure it out, because nobody ever helps anybody, not really. So what? I mean, you want me to go to a shrink, a pro, right? Professional help, that's what you're saying. Problem is, then I'll be helping them, giving them money. Are they going to pay me to pay them? No. Why not? That's half the problem right there. Money. Probably all of it. I'm so fucking terrorized by capitalism, I can't even fucking sleep. My defensiveness signaled for her to attack. Oh my God, she sighed. Get some sleeping pills, I don't know. She sat up. Her beauty stunned me. She seethed in that instant with a singular complex of disinterest and sanity. I gotta go home and get ready for work. I flopped onto my side. I curled my knees up to my gut. I pulled the sheets over my head. I added a pillow to give a little weight to the semi-darkness I needed to feed my bruised ego. I haven't seen her since. I never came up with any reason she should stay. She lost a lot of sleep. Her job demanded a lot from her. I have no interest in doctors. They feel like a crapshoot. You get prescribed whatever gets them the most kickbacks from the pharma boys. Or you get a holistic guy who tries to feed you mung beans and rice, tells you to meditate, go to the country. I just needed the nightmares to stop. Nothing more. But they never stopped. They kept coming. They reproduced. They multiplied. They almost looked the same. I recognized buildings, their facades, the streets that led to them and away from them, the rooms inside them. They had pastoral settings too. Seasides, grottos, hills, forests. The sky spoke a language that I readily understood but couldn't speak. Purple ones told me of a tentative victory. Orange ones hinted at the moist friction of a sudden passion. Integral, warm. Blue skies. Oh, the possibilities loomed endless, exultant yet weighty. But they never followed the same script. They used the same elements. That doesn't surprise me. They say the periodic table has 95. And out of that, you get the whole universe. If 100-odd elements can do that, maintain infinity. I didn't know what to do. One night I jumped off a building, splattered all over the sidewalk. Worse, everyone I loved stood around the mess I made, gawking, shaking their heads. My mom puked and fainted. My dad said he saw it coming. My sister wouldn't stop yelling at the smudge, calling me an asshole. You knew I loved you. You didn't call me. I told you to call me, motherfucker. My best pal from middle school, Rocky Sabala. I haven't seen him in years, which added to the guilt I wanted to choke back, but couldn't. I was dead. He showed up to tell my little brother. I was planning on calling him, man. That's why I asked you for his number. My brother soaked his face in a flood of tears. He wasn't a loser. I know he thought he was a loser, but he wasn't a loser. A whole mob had gathered. The milkman who gave me ice cream sandwiches on Fridays when I got home from second grade until my mother made him stop, had him fired. My first grade teacher, Miss Firestein, who I had a crush on until she came back from Christmas break. Now Mrs. McKenna, who crushed my little heart. Lindsey Graham, who I finally kissed my senior year because she got accepted to college in Paris. The thing that sucked, all these faces and more appeared simultaneously as I left the smudge on the cement my body became and slowly floated upwards, immaterial but still whole and real and complete as far as I felt. But no matter how much I hollered and hooted and yelled at them to let them know the situation clocked normal, nobody heard me. I tried to swat my little brother on the back of his head as a reminder of our childhood sibling rivalry, but no dice. My palm breezed right through him. He didn't detect so much as a butterfly's wings. My mom seemed to sense it. Her eyes fluttered back to consciousness, then popped wide open the way they used to do when she witnessed our roughhousing as kids. But now, she saw my ass, and the rest of me splattered like pancake batter on the pavement and fainted dead away once more. That son of a bitch. I knew it. Spineless son of a bitch, spat my old man. He never did care about his mother. I tried to talk, to argue with him. Did he care about mother? My mouth moved, but no words came out. Worse, I realized that whatever remained of me, spirit or soul or ethereal body, continued its slow ascent. I wafted above them, entangled in the smoke from the cigarette of a random passerby who abruptly turned into Ray Williams, the bartender who loved to tell me, "You're doomed, bud. Face it." Whether my inability to speak pained me more than their incapacity to discern me, I can't say. But this quandary quickly worsened as I imagined a future just so. I projected the scenario as a foundation for the years to come, an eternity of an existence remedy left came forth as a horrendous scream that startled me from sleep, landing me flat on my back, alone, in bed, covers tossed aside. I clicked then on my childhood fear of the dark and chuckled to think that now the near blackness of the room served as sanctuary. Once the foreboding soup of a puerile imagination gone wild, the pitch of this room now meant that the damnations of my mind had subsided. Only what to do next? Such eye-opening deliriums didn't fatigue me per se. More like a nervous watchfulness seized me. Not for what might lurk there in the room, nor in the world surrounding it, but for the frenzy that held my psyche in its clutches. I tried to analyze the situation rationally, empirically. This strategy never amounted to any hint of a resolution. I didn't really want to kill myself, not by jumping off a building or any other way. Then it occurred to me that the folklore I'd heard about exactly such scenarios, that the failure to awaken from a dream of falling would kill you, it had no basis. People who died by any means. Never reported back. I hadn't even died. Therefore, I had nothing to report but a dream, a vain imagining, wholly 100% unreal. It may sound like a lengthy hallucination, but it lasted maybe 5 minutes. The clock on the nightstand said 3:03, last I checked. Next time I looked, 3:16. I felt rotten. I got close to no sleep most nights. The 15 minutes of unconsciousness that preceded whatever tumult roused me went deep, but apparently not deep enough. An hour or so prior to the botched suicide psychosis, I had howled almost as wildly when it looked like the Nazis had come back for more, right in my neighborhood. They sported uniforms identical to the Hugo Boss ensembles from nearly a century ago. As usual, they rounded up only a select few at the intersection below my flat. I couldn't get a solid tally, but they carted away the workers, Korean, Hispanic, and Yemeni, from all three markets on the block. Like the other people they had spared, for now, I said nothing, though I gawked at length. It shocked me that no one else seemed to bat an eye or show the slightest alarm. That said, I behaved just as gutlessly as the rest of them. I bolted up the three flights to my apartment and found several friends gathered in the kitchen, drinking wine, smoking trees. Catching my breath, I sputtered as loud as I could. The fucking Nazis are here. They're downstairs rounding up colored people. The Nazis, I exaggerated. Crickets. You could hear a pin drop. An angel passed. All nine of the space invaders glared at me. Finally, as one, they dismissed my fear with a condescending brush off. Oh, Norman. My entire body throbbed. My blood boiled and gorged the vessels from my ears on down. Banshees at the farthest reaches of Dunsinane never keened more loudly. Other than my poor neighbors, I doubt anyone heard. Suffice it to say, I had done with nightmares right then and there. Frustrated, I taught myself to stay awake. In fact, I had already decided to do so when I dreamed up the building jumper story. Not long after this vision of my ultimate rooftop dive, a head trip I now rationalize per the miracle of hindsight as me self-penalizing for me self-blindsiding, a scolding in disguise that should have proved a no-brainer, I vowed to myself that I had done with sleep. But who willingly suspects that the symptoms of a thing merely act as parts of that thing, parts that really resemble either the roots or entirety of that same thing as a whole? Not me. Not then. I didn't know I already possessed the awareness needed to discover that neither nightmares nor sleep would eliminate the unrelenting trials that gradually erase the last vestiges of hope I couldn't consider without some figment of fantasy as ground. I mean, I felt like a self-loathing piece of steaming shit, even though the abundant conditions allowing me to feel that way remained readily available, perfectly close at hand. My first night awake presented the biggest hurdles. Having suffered too much of the quasi-insomnia that naturally comes of unceasing night terrors, I shouldered a mantle of fatigue I bet could put down a giant. of elemental creatures who toyed with me willy-nilly, not that I especially witnessed fey folk running amok or otherwise. Nonetheless, I intuited them as the agency behind the torrent of freaky glitches in mental perception appearing as shadowy flashes just outside the corner of an eye trained the other way. They backed up their antics with staccato titters drawn over a scattered cacophony of creaks, scrapes, crashes, squeals, hoots, grunts, thuds, whists, plinks, splooks, snaps, crinkles, chitters, clops, lips, and claps. I could scarcely locate my own fleeting impressions of all that piqued my eyes and ears, let alone any certain origins for the kinetic chaos that seemed to surround me. Nothing about this disturbed me or registered as alarmingly aberrant. In a sense, my determination to achieve sanity without somnolence melded with the cavalcade of hallucinations that conspired to deny me even an iota of peace. No matter, what I hadn't banked on came as a kind of revelation, for the sustained deprivation of one's sleep informs not only a paradigm for a will surrendered to disciplined activity, it further enhances such ubiquitous awareness, it eases ready access to ludic encounters that defy the empirical habits allowing the brisk business of space-time and linear causation. In other words, I eventually found it simple as fuck to trip to life fantastic and crush the everyday demands of cultural conformity. For example, I don't know how many waking nights had passed when I arrived at the office and discovered the ability to duplicate my persona. I can't say why this basic impulse seemed to turn out more flawlessly than a host of fanciful undertakings I had roundly fumbled until then, whether business or leisure, projects I had planned obsessively in any great detail. But no sooner did I click on the overhead fluorescent that floods the brutalist office chamber befitting a dutiful factotum than I choked back a chortle of disgust. I didn't deserve this sentence, not today. Instead, I endeavored to spend who knew how long exploring the unreported regions of the unlimited wholeness. Maybe they would reveal their inconsistencies to the genuinely sleepless. In the desert of parasomnia, I crossed the spirit of the Sirocco on the breath of a mighty wild ass I trained to bray as needed, staving off bad dreams and murderous inclinations, and the ridicule of giants. I routed a stampede of horses led by a voluptuous goddess with the head of a chestnut mare that plainly drove her to shoulder a hideous madness. I unshod 9 hooves with my nails. I felt no fear as the shoes morphed into ghosts, then into 9 harpies, then to all the muses whom memory names poesis, epic, historic, music, comedic, tragic, sacred, danced, and astronomical. Finding these inspirations incarnated, I quickly decided their orgiastic revels would strengthen my genitals, and I threw myself greedily upon the fleshy floor of the meat market. The spites, coming in the shape of mischief and illusion, had no effect on me, and I foiled the plot they tried to hatch. Stupid apes, I cursed at them, you're neither merchants nor the pets of Iberian ladies. Be gone. And so they went, not underground or to their caverns, but to a green sepulchral island where I eluded sunstroke and siesta. Here I ensured that the mouth of the river spoke. In this way, I mastered the mimicry commonly faced in the delusional verisimilitude of dreams. My dutiful doppelganger crushed each of the day's cases without me ever entering chambers, while I started to meander the sidewalks that join the streets to every neighborhood park and waterfront of the famed island. I simultaneously exonerated a dozen dope fiends and 2 shelterless denizens without right dismissals of all charges plus compensation from both the state and municipality. My double demonstrated such competence that I relieved him with a 3rd, so he could enjoy the rest of the day at his pleasure. I don't expect this information to appear credible, notwithstanding the credit so many persons give to mythologies as primitive as news and weather reports, psychologists and their ilk, secular and religious evangelists, political power brokers left, right, and center, and the audacious artifice that for the sake of economies affirms scarcity in a universe long known to surpass all limits. Who pretends to see with eyes contends that only matter comprises the material realm, neglects the reality that light incorporates energy without prejudice. Since the movements of the atoms are as varied, it's not unbelievable that the atoms once came together in this way, or that at some point they will come together like this again, giving birth to another like me. The so-called alien fascinates people blinded by the eye, by what the eyes can see, like all fictions created to imitate science, as if science espoused some truth dressed up as answers to feed who hungers for belief. In fact, the true scientist questions everything, including their own provable answers. Why else would a complete system harbor inconsistencies in the same way that evidence of inconsistency indicates a complete system? I don't know, but you could ask Gödel. I experience forms unhinged from space. I accept the soundtrack that promotes the silence around a scree floated wide of its hawk. A distant elephant's trumpeted warning barrels around the corner before the crushing peace of a public bus. I grind steel, sparking subway wheels, screaming between sound lines. Down the iron track supporting my neck. Sinewy magnetics hot on the rushing blood, colonizing the extremities it abandoned. I don't captain this ship, as if any ever did. I unhanded the wheel to a song in the mire that breathes us paired oxygens intent on blackening unseen carbon quotients. I address your retina to get you to touch this. The words of things shut out the percussives that greased senses send in one palpably somatic psyche, mimicked to make me liminal. Repeated three times as six rooted eye and almost square between skin. Dead tree skin flakes mix dad flesh and barista meat, mycelium bark, scratch on mouse dander for dust collecting as earth. Dead tree skin flakes mix dad flesh and barista meat, mycelium bark, scratch on mouse dander for dust collecting as earth. Oh, everything must go. To earth, growth spores, spiral, linked, and patterned flat as sine curves, writing RGB hexagon steps yonder and wild. White, black, blinking, twinkling, I ride by. Something a thought thinks things needed to give more thought to this. Specific words anchored to the symbols of order, carved into the nonlinear points of a cyclical rhythm construed as a sequence in the unquantified surrender to time's narrow infinity. The perfect already corrected this, of course. I'll ignore loving stretches, longed for under me, living the bridge, hammering away at wall of night, silenced as if holy sleep lies, a spell unperturbed. With the equator leveled directly at sun, we still swallow the premise of hourly space. Some promise to outer a lot winged south through a motion all moon, flock of honking, who hops up on purpose you vaguely recall squirrely, unscrewed. The bees don't go for your September cupcake or soda, don't go for you neither, or me for that matter. Keep only nothing, or this, seated wide-eyed among the wall-eyed, and your fish, the wee, the little, the humble to be, owls and other heads that roll, talons for eyes, coins to pierce distance like oracles upholding the fake lack of light. I can't sleep in spite of our sleep, not because of. In lieu of this, I can't sleep because no sleeping exists. You don't sleep now. You don't know while you sleep that you dream, or that while you dream, you sleep. What makes you so sure you don't dream or sleep right now? Tell you what doesn't happen? That is what I am. How I am doing. A goose convinced that conditions deliver him the necessary. A gratitude unlike none of the other grifters playing first creature of dirt. Exhumed, therefore human. We ride inside the hollowed out sky. Night, day, night, day, light, light, light. Campfire sparkling the bowl of a black-bodied godless goddess. It doesn't end here, and all of it is all of ours, and all of ours is all of its, made for us and for it. The only waking moment is the moment we awake, before the dreaming resumes to mirror the forgetting that starts at the fall into sleep. Of course, in the dream no one sleeps. Why, I know. I can't sleep anymore. I said I was going to read something by one of those Russian guys. I was going to play Russian roulette. Pick one. But it changed my mind. Instead, I'm going to read three versions of Judas by Jorge Luis Borges. This is from the book Bixiones, from a translation he collaborated on with, I think, Norman Thomas DiGiovanni. Apparently, he had some kind of feud with his wife, hence the terrible translations offered by Penguin. As done by some guy named Hurley. But, you know, all of New York Times and everybody says they're great, so don't listen to me. Anyways, three versions of Judas by Jorge Luis Borges from the publication titled Ficciones. In Asia Minor, or in Alexandria, in the second century of our faith, when Basilides was announcing that the cosmos was a rash and malevolent improvisation engineered by defective angels, Niels Runeberg might have directed, with a singular intellectual passion, one of the Gnostic conventicles. Dante would have destined him, perhaps, for a fiery sepulcher. His name might have augmented the catalogues of heresiarchs between Saturnibus and Carpocrates. Some fragment of his preaching, embellished with invective, might have been preserved in the apocryphal Liber Adversus Omnis Heresis, or might have perished when the firing of a monastic library consumed the last example of the syntagmia. Instead, God assigned him to the 20th century and to the university city of Lund. There, in 1904, he published the first edition of Christus Augustus. There, in 1909, his masterpiece, Dem Heimliche Verharren, appeared. Of this last mentioned work, there exists a German version called Der Heimliche Heiland, executed in 1912 by Emil Schering. I think, I don't know if you know that Lund is in Sweden and that those two titles were initially in Swedish, not German, but I'm just letting you know that. Anyways, before undertaking an examination of the foregoing works, it is necessary to repeat that Niels Runeberg, a member of the National Evangelical Union, was deeply religious. In some salon in Paris or even in Buenos Aires, a literary person might well rediscover Runeberg's theses, but these arguments presented in such a setting would seem like frivolous and idle exercises in irrelevance or blasphemy. To Runeberg, they were the key with which to decipher a central mystery of theology. They were a matter of meditation and analysis, of historic and philologic controversy, of loftiness, of jubilation, and of terror. They justified and destroyed his life. Whoever peruses this essay should know that it states only Runeberg's conclusions, not his dialectic or his proof. Someone may observe that no doubt the conclusion preceded the proofs, for who gives himself up to looking for proofs of something he does not believe in, or the predication of which he does not care about? The first edition of Christus Augustus bears the following categorical epigraph, whose meaning some years later Niels Runeberg himself would monstrously dilate. Not one thing, but everything tradition attributes to Judas Iscariot is false. This is found in De Quincey, Thomas De Quincey, in a text of 1857. Preceded in his speculation by some German thinker, De Quincey opined that Judas had betrayed Jesus Christ in order to force him to declare his divinity and thus set off a vast rebellion against the yoke of Rome. Runeberg offers a metaphysical vindication. Skillfully, he begins by pointing out how superfluous was the act of Judas. He observes, as did Robertson, that in order to identify a master who daily preached in the synagogue and who performed miracles before gatherings of thousands, the treachery of an apostle is unnecessary. This nevertheless occurred. To suppose an error in scripture is intolerable. No less intolerable is it to admit that there was a single haphazard act in the most precious drama in the history of the world. Ergo, the treachery of Judas was not accidental. It was a predestined deed which has its mysterious place in the economy of the redemption. Runeberg continues, "The word, when it was made flesh, passed from ubiquity into space, from eternity into history, from blessedness without limit to mutilation and death. In order to correspond to such a sacrifice, it was necessary that a man, as representative of all men, make a suitable sacrifice. Judas Iscariot was that man. Judas, alone among the apostles, intuited the secret divinity and the terrible purpose of Jesus. The Word had lowered himself to be mortal. Judas, disciple of the world, could lower himself to the role of informer. The word transgression, dishonor, abides. And welcome the fire, which cannot be extinguished. The lower order is a mirror of the superior order. The forms of the earth correspond to the forms of the heavens. the stains on the skin are a map of the incorruptible constellations. Judas in some way reflects Jesus, thus the 30 pieces of silver and the kiss, thus deliberate self-destruction in order to deserve damnation all the more. In this manner did Niels Runeberg elucidate the enigma of Judas. The theologians of all the confessions refuted him. Lars Peter Engström accorded him of ignoring or of confining to the past the hypostatic union of the Divine Trinity. Axel Borelius charged him with renewing the heresy of the Docetists, who denied the humanity of Jesus. The sharp-edged Bishop of Lund denounced him for contradicting the third verse of chapter 22 of the Gospel of St. Luke. These various anathemas influenced Runeberg, who partially rewrote the disapproved book and modified his doctrine. He abandoned the terrain of theology to his adversaries and postulated oblique arguments of a moral order. He admitted that Jesus, who could count on the considerable resources which omnipotence offers, did not need to make use of a man to redeem all men. Later, he refuted those who affirmed that we know nothing. That we know nothing of the inexplicable traitor. We know, he said, that he was one of the apostles, one of those chosen to announce the kingdom of heaven, to cure the sick, to cleanse the leprous, to resurrect the dead, and to cast out demons. A man whom the Redeemer has thus distinguished deserves from us the best interpretations of his deeds. To impute his crime to cupidity, as some have done, citing John 12:6, is to resign oneself to the most torpid motive force. Niels Runeberg proposes an opposite moving force, an extravagant and even limitless asceticism. The ascetic for the greater glory of God degrades and mortifies the flesh. Judas did the same with the spirit. He renounced honor, good, peace, the kingdom of heaven, as others, less heroically, renounced pleasure. With a terrible lucidity, he premeditated his offense. In adultery, there's usually tenderness and self-sacrifice. In murder, courage. In profanation and blasphemy, a certain satanic splendor. Judas elected those offenses unvisited by any virtues, abuse of confidence, and informing. He labored with gigantic humility. He thought himself unworthy to be good. Paul has written, "Whoever glorifieth himself, let him glory himself in God." Judas sought hell because the felicity of the Lord sufficed him. He thought that happiness, like good, is a divine attribute, not to be usurped by men. Many have discovered post factum that in the justifiable beginnings of Runeberg lies his extravagant end, and that dem hemlige Fralsaren, is a mere perversion or exacerbation of Christus of Eulis. Toward the end of 1907, Runeberg finished and revised the manuscript text. Almost 2 years passed without his handing it to the printer. In October of 1909, the book appeared with a prologue, tepid to the point of being enigmatic, by the Danish Hebraist Erik Erfjord, and bearing this perfidious epigraph. In the world he was, and the world was made by him, and the world knew him not. That's from John chapter 1, verse 10. The general argument is not complex, even if the conclusion is monstrous. God, argues Niels Runeberg, lowered himself to be a man for the redemption of the human race. It is reasonable to assume that the sacrifice offered by him was perfect, not invalidated or attenuated by any omission. To limit all that happened to the agony of one afternoon on the cross is blasphemous. To affirm that he was a man and that he was incapable of sin contains a contradiction. The attributes of impeccabilitas and of humanitas are not compatible. Chemnitz, admits that the Redeemer could feel fatigue, cold, confusion, hunger, thirst, it's reasonable to admit that it could also sin and be damned. The famous text, "He will sprout like a root in a dry soil. There is not good mane in him, nor beauty, despised of men and the least of them, a man of sorrow and experienced in heartbreaks," Isaiah 53:2-3, was for many people a forecast of the crucified and the hour of his death. For some, as for instance Hans Lassen Martensen, it is a refutation of the beauty which the vulgar consensus attributes to Christ. For Runeberg, it is a precise prophecy, not of one moment, but of all the atrocious future, in time and eternity, of the Word made flesh. God became a man completely, a man to the point of infamy, a man to the point of being reprehensible, all the way to the abyss, in order to save us. He could have chosen any of the destinies which together weave the uncertain web of history. He could have been Alexander, or Pythagoras, or a runk, or Jesus. He chose an infamous destiny. He was Judas. In vain did the bookstores of Stockholm and Lund offer this revelation. The incredulous considered it a priori an insipid and laborious theological game. The theologians disdained it. Runeberg intuited from this universal indifference an almost miraculous confirmation. God had commanded this indifference. God did not wish his terrible secret propagated in the world. Runeberg understood that the hour had not yet come. He sensed ancient and divine curses converging upon him. He remembered Elijah and Moses, who covered their faces on the mountaintop so as not to see God. He remembered Isaiah, who prostrated himself when his eyes saw that one whose glory fills the earth. Saul, who was blinded on the road to Damascus. The rabbi Simon ben Azai, who saw paradise and died. The famous soothsayer, John of Viterbo, who went mad when he was able to see the Trinity. The Midrashim, abominating the impious who pronounce the Shem Hamaphorash, the secret name of God. Wasn't he perchance guilty of this dark crime? Might not this be the blasphemy against the Spirit, the sin which will not be pardoned? Valerius Soranus died for having revealed the occult name of Rome. What infinite punishment would be Lund's for having, Runeberg's for his having discovered and divulged the terrible name of God. Intoxicated with insomnia and with vertiginous dialectic, Niels Runeberg wandered through the streets of Malmo, praying aloud that he be given the grace to share hell with the Redeemer. He died of the rupture of an aneurysm on the first day of March in 1912. The writers on heresy, the heresiologists, will no doubt remember him. He added to the concept of the sun, which seemed exhausted, the complexities of calamity and of evil. That was Aurelius Boas. Three versions of Judas. He had some footnotes. The first footnote references, where is it up here? Sorry about this. Oh, the first footnote is a short one. He says, Borelius mockingly interrogates, "Why Did he not renounce to renounce? Why not renounce renouncing? I mean, that's a simple enough footnote in itself. It doesn't really matter what it refers to. The second footnote, Euclides, De Cunha, and a book ignored by Runeberg. I mean, this is like the beauty of Borges, okay? It's kind of like, anyways. I suppose this is what I'm striving for ultimately, you know? To speak about not only the unspeakable, but the unspoken. So, he says that he's talking about this guy Runeberg for the entire article. And then he mentions a book that Runeberg ignored. Notes that for the Heresiarch of Cartudos, Antonio Consigliero, virtue was a kind of impiety almost. An Argentine reader, Borges is Argentine, could recall analogous passages in the work of Almafuerte. Runeberg published in the symbolist sheet Stu and Sigol an assiduously descriptive poem called The Secret Water. The first stanzas narrate the events of one tumultuous day. The last stanzas, the finding of a glacial pool. The poet suggests that the eternalness of this silent water checks our useless violence, and in some way allows and absolves it. The poem concludes in this way. The water of the forest is still and felicitous, and we can be vicious and full of pain. Okay, the third note. Borges says that Maurice Abramovich observes Jésus d'après ce Scandinave toujours le beau rôle se déboire grâce à la science des typographes jouisse d'une réputation polyglotte. Sa résidence de 33 ans parmi les humains ne fut en somme qu'une vieillature. Erfjord, in the third appendix, the Christelliga Dogmatica, refutes this passage. He writes that the crucifying of God has not ceased, for anything which has happened once in time is repeated ceaselessly through all eternity. Judas now continues to receive the pieces of silver. He continues to hurl the pieces of silver in the temple. He continues to knot the hangman's noose on the field of blood. Erfjord, to justify this affirmation, invokes the last chapter of the first volume of The Vindication of Eternity by Jaromir Hladík. The French translation, I'm going to do off the cuff. Jesus, according to the Scandinavian, this Scandinavian, Runeberg, always is the good guy. Sobriety, thanks to the science of typography, draws from a polyglot reputation. Jesus' residence, 33-year residency among the humans, only made In some. Like, kind of like the village idiot. Anyways, that was Borges. This is me, and you are you. And you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. Like I said earlier, give your money by going to the WGXC.org during the pledge drive, click on donate, and make a pledge. That way you can keep this radio going with or without me, but it'll still be going, and that's what counts. I mean, not like I'm announcing like that I'm splitting or anything like that. I'm just saying, with or without me, the radio can go on with you. Not without you. So give it up. I have about 2 minutes left. I'm not going to read anything. I'm going to note, I'm really disturbed today because I heard like 4 times an Amber Alert. I got to turn all those emergency things off on my phone. But in different places, this Amber Alert kept coming on because people have that stuff on their phones. And the responses were like ultimately ghoulish. I don't know. That's just my attitude towards most stuff that's going on in the news. That people who like pay attention to the news are not much different from ghouls. I wouldn't really say zombies because they're not really after brains. Because information doesn't really take brains. What information does is it forms whatever used to be a brain. That's what it does. Like other things like infest or infect, information is kind of a synonym for that, for like infestation, infection. I mean, you know, I'm not saying don't read books or anything like that. I'm just talking about this stuff that, you know, passes for news and other government advertising, corporate-sponsored crap that gets mass-marketed and spoon-fed like Soylent Green, except that Soylent Green is human, and news and information are not. They're diabolical. So give your money to WGXC so you can hear angels like me. Tell you that the economy will never destroy the ecology. And if you don't know why, then you haven't learned the language. Alright, you've been listening to WGXC. Tune in to